Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for this week's edition of the SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup. I'm your host, Marty Bennett, and today on the Roundup, we're going to be taking a look at three important issues that we have questions about related to international education. And hopefully we come up today with some of those answers and what's important in our world today as international educators. So I encourage all of you to stick with me over the next half hour as we discuss the important issues of our day. As for those of you who are not familiar with the Roundup, we do this every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, and we go over the top issues in our field that we've come across our news feeds in the last 7 days. And most recently, we've begun asking the right questions. Not just covering the stories, but asking the right questions and hopefully coming to a conclusion as to what some of these answers might be for our individual institutions. So what are we talking about today? Well, for those of you who are fans of the Roundup, you know we get our news stories each week from our newsletter that comes out Monday morning, all the SMIE news fit to share. That newsletter arrives in your inbox at 9 a.m. Eastern. Every Monday morning, and in it we categorize our news stories into international ed and social media stories, SMIE, social media, international ed. And we choose three of those stories each week and highlight those for you here on the Roundup. And what I certainly encourage you to, if you want a sneak peek each week for what the Roundup's going to look like, get that newsletter delivered to your inbox every Monday, and you'll have a sense of what we'll be covering here on Wednesday. And for those of you who are listening on the podcast, thank you so much for downloading us and putting us on your rotation as you work from home, as you exercise, as you just look to take a break from your day-to-day and get a perspective on what we're doing in international ed. So thank you very much for taking the time out of your week to either join us live or be a part of our on-demand properties on Facebook and our YouTube channel, as well as our podcasts. So what are the three questions we're going to ask today? If you are familiar with NAFSA, the leading international ed membership organization in the world, the largest at least, they released an issues brief directed at members of Congress last week. And that issues brief detailed some very specific recommendations for what they saw as some of the important priorities that they didn't want to get lost in the shuffle with everything going on with the various stimulus packages, the pandemic. We've had 3.5 phases of this of the relief bailouts, that if you want to call it that, to help keep the country going and moving forward. And part of NAFSA's recommendations in this issues brief, I've posted the link to it on the comments section on the Facebook page for SMIE Consulting, so you'll be able to find that link there if you don't already have it. But it does lay out four very clear objectives. First, to direct emergency aid to support education abroad, specifically supporting virtual exchanges, the increasing and diversifying education abroad for U.S. students program, and funds for the improvement of post-secondary education, the FIPSI grants that many of you are familiar with. Second, to ensure that international students and scholars are able to return to the United States when in-person classes resume, whenever that is. We'll talk about that in a bit. To mitigate the continued decline of international student enrollment by exercising oversight of visa and immigration policies. Third, direct $46.6 billion in aid from the CARES Acts that have been going out to students in higher ed institutions with flexibility to support study abroad and international offices, because those are ones that are obviously the most directly affected with the drops in international students and study abroad participants. And fourth, to make changes to the Small Business Administration Paycheck Protection Program so that international education providers are eligible and smaller private higher ed institutions do not include student employees in the total number of employees. So that's referencing a lot of the study abroad providers that many of you are familiar with, CIE having laid off 600 people in the last month. as a result of the pandemic. So there's a lot more like CIEE that will be doing likewise if the study abroad situation does not improve. And who knows when that's going to take off. Certainly the fall is going to be much like, if not worse, more directly impacted by universities that are going, still deciding whether to go online or in person or some hybrid version for how they meet in the fall. They're also going to be impacted there with that. So the NAFSA recommendations in this issue brief, they do go into specifics on in further details, which we won't go into here. But certainly the what they're outlining here certainly are reasonable from an international educator's perspective. And certainly as the leading international ed membership organization in the world, making sure that we are represented at the table, that our needs are being addressed with some of these requests that NAFSA is making. Who knows when or if any of this will get passed, but NAFSA is certainly fighting that good fight. And advocacy does not just begin and end with our membership organizations. It's down to us as individuals too. So NAFSA on their site does have some excellent resources that certainly outline what universities and university staff and members who are actively engaged in international education and with their how they can easily translate these messages into easily digestible bites for members of Congress to encourage them to act on these and to not let international education get lost in the shuffle. And with this administration, certainly with the priorities on America First, international things tend to get the back seat. And that's unless it's a trade deal or whatever it might be. But international ed, as we all know, is an important part of the U.S. economy and certainly contributes a significant amount of revenue to institutions, but also local communities where international students decide to attend. So we've talked about those numbers before. Won't go into that here. But certainly we can't let NAFSA just do it on their own. It's incumbent upon us as international educators to make the case to our representatives, to our elected representatives, that we need to be on the front lines too and encouraging them to support our industry, our livelihoods. I know there are a number of international educators who have recently been furloughed or let go entirely, and that's devastating at this stage. Talking to one of my university clients over the last couple of days, they are almost going into retrenchment mode. They're eliminating positions that they had overseas that had recently been started up in the last 2 to 3 years. They're seeing making some serious financial decisions that are going to impact their institution long term, and it may be some time before they come out of it and see value again in international education. Because right now we're hurting. We're all hurting as an industry. There's no two ways around it. That's just our reality today. And what we need to do in order to get ahead of this and be on the front edge of what's possible for our industry moving forward, we'll talk about what some of those solutions are to keep international students engaged in our third question of the day. But before that ever happens, we have to get our own houses in order and know what we're doing. And frankly, there is so much confusion right now in the industry as to whether our campuses will be able to open in the fall. And I've referenced in the newsletter this week, as well as just now dropping the link in the comments section, Inside Higher Ed had a fairly detailed scenario of cases, what higher ed might look like in the fall in the United States. And it's an insightful article, and I certainly recommend your institution is going to be somewhere on this list of potential realities for you in the fall. And it's by Edward J. Maloney and Joshua Kim. I certainly encourage you to read it because it will help give perspective and some scenarios on here that might be useful if your institution doesn't have these already laid out. They're probably moving in one of these directions or another, but the back to normal as if nothing had ever happened, that's a reality that is going to be probably the absolutes. Certainly a very distinct minority of institutions will probably fall into that category in the fall. Second would be a late start, just a delaying the beginning of the first term, fall term, to October or even November, whenever social distancing restrictions can be relaxed and other larger on-campus events might be able to happen again. Who knows if that's even possible in the near future, even this calendar year. Third option is moving fall to spring, so not having anything on or off campus in the fall, and just starting the fall semester in January 2021. So then that means starting the school year that would run through summer, perhaps, and do a spring and a summer as your academic year. Third would be a first year intensive, where this would be how a student, and this is from the article, how a student begins their college experience may be the best predictor of how the college experience will end. So recognize the importance of the first year and the first few weeks or months of the transition to college. This plan brings only first year students to campus in the fall. Interesting. First year students learn in residential classes while also participating in the full range of campus-based orientation and social connection exercises. Sophomores, juniors, and seniors continue to learn remotely for the fall, and I assume that would bring them back to campus in the spring. Interesting thought there. Graduate students only. Flip that last one around, where instead of just first year students, it's only grad students, doing that on campus, and research intensive and face-to-face instruction for small groups that grad cohorts typically are in. Outlining a structured gap year. This could be using extensive study abroad programs that might already exist if they're even functioning in the fall. Or gap year options. So gap years is the traditional British model where after students finish secondary school, they then go on a work or volunteer experience for a year. This option here potentially includes project-based experiences that could be implemented and managed according to the article while social distancing rules are still in place. Again, that depends on whether there are even options for travel. To make that possible, so at least outside the United States. Within the United States, that might be more of a reality. Next, targeted curriculum, and this would be reducing the number of courses being offered to limit on-campus density and to prioritize support resources. Another one is split curriculum, a block plan, modularity of students in residence but learning virtually, so you'd still fill the residence halls and the cafeterias, and that certainly funding wise is a model that a lot of universities probably find attractive. One of the two campuses we'll talk about, Purdue, has a model that might look something like that. A 12th idea is a low residency model. This would be like many online and executive programs work now. Students would come to campus for intensive face-to-face experiences and then return home to complete the semester online. And there are a lot of, on the international side, there are a lot of these programs that exist that allow students, require students to be on campus maybe one semester or one weekend a month or two weekends a semester, then do everything else remotely during the year. Obviously, that would have limitations for international students, particularly for new ones that might be able to join in time for the fall. A lot of issues with some of these models as it relates to international students, given current immigration regulations. So it's still, depending on the university, there will be a lot of issues on that front, I'm sure. Another 13th option is a high flex model, and that's the one that is one of the most flexible and maybe most attractive, according to the article, but it's also one of the most difficult when it comes to faculty. In this model, according to the article, courses would be taught both face-to-face and online by the same instructor at the same time, and students could choose to return to campus or stay home, so that those on campus could be assigned certain class slots when face-to-face is an option, allowing the school greater control of social distancing in the classroom. Obviously, that's we talked about that a couple weeks ago, about what large lecture halls would look like in a social distancing world. So this would provide synchronous learning, and that may involve a TA or course assistant to manage the online students. So a 14th option is a modified tutorial model. And that gives the university and students a great deal of flexibility. In that model, students take common online lecture sessions, and faculty or TAs would then meet in small groups. And certainly that's a method that when I was a graduate student in history and at Marquette University, I was a TA. The faculty member did the lecture. It was in a large lecture hall. And then we had small groups that did the discussion sections of that larger class. So that certainly makes sense. So we'll see what that happens. And then the final option, fully remote and doing everything online. And that is the most obvious option, apparently, for many institutions. That more and more, though, I'm hearing institutions, we heard of Brown the past week, and other Ivies are starting to fall into place that way, who are looking to actually hold on-campus courses as per normal this fall. We've heard Purdue, and we'll talk about that option in a little bit as to what their plans are. So those institutions they may want to do that in terms of holding their class. Everybody would want to have their campus fully loaded and ready to go this fall. But the realities of health requirements for international students in particular, since that's what we're primarily talking about here, them even being able to get to campus, these are very significant issues that are going to be roadblocks to for institutions that are heavily reliant on international students for their fall class each year, 10-15%, you could be talking significant hits that you'll be taking this fall if you haven't already realized that. So definitely some very interesting options on the table there, and we'll be keeping an eye on that. The two campuses that are kind of profiled here in this next story from the Chronicle are Cal State Fullerton and Purdue University. And these are kind of the two extremes, if you will, in terms of what the plans are. The provost at Cal State Fullerton said that the university plans to start the fall term online and then gradually move back to on-campus operations. Whereas Purdue University, their president, Mitch Daniels, former governor of the state of Indiana, has been the university president there for a number of years. He is intending to bring back students to campus in August. And he emailed the campus community last week, and that he said that Purdue is determined not to surrender helplessly to the difficulties of the virus. And he talks through the economic costs of shutting down campus that are not only financial but are human costs of doing that. And there's a lot of what Purdue's doing is some very deep thinking, frankly, in terms of what campus interactions will look like. And it's something that's a very bold plan as far as I'm concerned. It will look at how different communities on the campus are able to interact or not, that the students might be able to still meet in classrooms, and then the instructors, there's even talk about having them do remote instruction to large lecture classes and then be available for one-on-ones. But the health requirements need to be put in place and he talks a lot about the risks to the different age groups, where the 35 and above are those that are obviously the staff and faculty of institutions that are going to be most in that category, that there would be ways that they would be separated on campus, which is interesting given the student-faculty interactions that typically have to happen. So the reality, and where I think we'll get to some of these discussions in the coming weeks, I think about what some of the greatest hurdles are to doing an online-only model is revenue-wise for institutions. They're going to take huge hits anyway with potential drops in new student enrollments. Even returning students might be hesitant to come back. There's going to be a lot of fear, unfortunately, that's going to be a reality of our existence for the next year or two until the vaccine is readily available and people's fears are eased. But you look at what institutions like Purdue are doing, that they're thinking about all the potential elements that are involved here. And I certainly would encourage all of you to check out the email. I'll drop the link to from that message to the Purdue community in the comments section as well, because I think that's very instructive to give you kind of all the ways that they, the pieces of the puzzle that they've thought through as they're going, discussing what the options will look like for them this fall. So there are a lot of weeks yet to go before we get to fall term beginning, but planning has to happen now. And any of you who have organized orientation programs for new students, realize, and new international students, there you have questions, their parents have questions, you're dealing with these every day. And this is something that no one really has all the answers right now. Your campus, if they're going to commit to something one way or another, some are going to be able to delay, but the more you delay without giving your prospective students that are already admitted, maybe are still hedging their bets on whether they're going to come or not, the less likely you're going to be able to get a full class in the fall, if that's the goal, to have a seated class. If you're thinking ahead, and we've talked about this option before for international offices, if you're thinking ahead about what your fall might look like, is there an option where one of these high flex options where students can start taking classes? International students can be admitted if you're going on, if their course is going to be online anyway, for a portion of your students. Are there a set of these online first year courses that they can take, where you add in an international orientation piece where it's an ongoing thing for them that you're keeping them engaged throughout that first term, and then bringing them to campus for the first time in January or whenever your spring term begins? That's probably the most realistic option for keeping engaged your admitted students, to have them enroll in something this fall, albeit through online learning. The advantages are obviously they won't have to go through the visa process in order to do the online program in the fall, and then they would be coming in as a second semester first year student in January, at a time when the consulates and embassies will be open up again. There's talk of some of them opening up in the next month or 6 weeks. So if that happens, great. But that's coming at a time when, yes, they're going to be given priority access as students to be able to hopefully get there in the fall. But there's already going to be a 2-month backlog of appointments that these consulates and embassies will need to take care of. So who's to say whether that's a realistic option to expect a fully seated international class this fall? A realistic option is not. That is not going to be possible. So what is your institution doing to accommodate that group of students? Obviously, you don't want to lose them. If you're going to lose them, you're probably going to lose them to home in-country options. They're probably not going to come at all. If they're not going to come to you, they're probably not going to come to the U.S. at all for the fall. So the reality is, what options are you working with them if you want to keep them engaged for the spring term? So we'll talk, and if not enrolling online for the fall. So we'll talk about what some of that looks like in the future as we get further on down the road with this. But the challenges are vast, and I don't envy my on-campus colleagues at all in this next 3-4 months. Before the fall term begins, because you're facing incredible stresses in your own lives with what might be happening in your own families, with employment, with health issues. All of these things are, your mental well-being has certainly been put through the ringer over the last few months. But now we're in a situation where you don't know whether you're going to be able to get your class in the fall. And if you're not already planning for something like that to happen, these conversations need to be happening up the chain, and you need to be at the table, hopefully, when they do. But there are some practical steps that your institutions can be taking. And this was an article that I saw this week out of Education Dive, and it's actually a very surprisingly honest and open call to action by the president of College of St. Rose in New York, and its associate vice president for global affairs as well. They penned this article about their recommendations, and they came up with a number of different number of things that institutions can be doing now. And they talk from the top about the issues that international students are in right now, that they they don't know whether current international students, whether they're going to be able to return to finish their studies, let alone the new students that might be wanting to come, that some of them did stay on campus because they couldn't get home either physically or financially. So it's those students that are also part of the puzzle, let alone the new students coming in. And the president, in her letter, she makes the case that the needs of international students were not always well understood. However, as college administrators quickly developed plans to send students living on campus to move all instruction online and to close libraries, health centers, and other sites that serve students, depending on state mandates, some also had very little time to transition all but those deemed essential personnel. So those are some of the challenges that they were facing. So, but the responsibility for advocating for international students has been assumed by, that role has been assumed by the people who most closely work with them, your ISSS staff. Now, playing a role are obviously international student recruitment officers, support staff, and global administrators, SIOs on campus, that type of thing. And those obviously in upper management and leadership in institutions that were international students themselves or had significant international experiences also have a spot in their hearts for those students, that they make sure that those issues are not forgotten. But sometimes that's not, you're at institutions where that isn't the case, where your president might not have the capacity or bandwidth to really understand international, and really understand international. So SIOs have to fill that role. So their recommendations are fairly significant and common sense. And when you think about it, well, first is developing student-centered best practices to serve international students during the pandemic. Next, and one I could not agree with more, and that's advocating for new processes for student visas and what that means in terms of when they reopen, whether it's even possible to get those students prioritized and get here in time for the fall. And their next recommendation is convening an online global government summit on higher education. There's travel restrictions that even if we open up, we don't know every other country in the world is going to be opening up for their students to either leave or study abroad students to come in, whatever it might be. So there's a lot of if ands and that we don't know yet, circumstances that have not been thought of yet. What happens if this country isn't open or consulates in this country are open, but their government won't let them fly out, or the U.S. government won't let them fly in. So there's still a lot to be decided in this time. One of the other components that we've heard, particularly for incoming students and for current students that are affected by this, is the need to increase financial aid for international students. And this probably is coming not at the worst possible time. For all but the wealthiest of institutions that have endowments that have also taken hits recently, but colleges that are reliant on those international students, that if they have not already been providing international students financial aid, this is a call to increase that amount. And finally, it's creating new models of education, higher education, that these hybrids that we talked about earlier in that Inside Higher Ed article with the 15 ways campuses might open this fall. And then also redoubling support for optional practical training and internships, because as a value add to what U.S. higher education is all about, those have been some of the hallmarks of why students come, is the work experience that's possible. Though the current administration talks quite a big talk about not supporting that and preferring to go America first for everything, the reality is they have become an important part of our experiences in the United States, of our economic enterprise in the United States, and it's a value of that our country provides, and providing a pathway to permanent residency and citizenship is a long way off here in this country, a clear and defined pathway. In the current political environment, that's probably not a reality, but it's certainly something that would make, this does provide that at least initial step after degrees are done to get that experience that can eventually lead to work and permanent residency here. But there's a lot of unanswered questions, obviously. So great article from Education Dive, from these colleges, St. Rose Administration President and SIO. So definitely recommend giving that a read. The final is one that I always talk about from University World News, and that has to do with conversion and how important that is for your incoming class, obviously. And this talks through the realities that obviously folks aren't visiting right now campus. They can't. If you haven't already had digital elements into your conversion plan from admitted student to enrolled for yield events or admitted student events, you're now in a situation where you have to do everything online. Some of you who have already been thinking this over the past few years already have these elements built in. You just need to put those on steroids a bit. Others of you who haven't had virtual elements to the yield end of the funnel have had to create the wheel. And there are certainly a lot of vendors who are willing to jump in and help fill that void for you. But you've had to do this. And right now, your website needs, is it going to be a continual place? Students are going to come, parents are going to come for information about what the next step is for them, how COVID-19 is impacting your campus. So it's incumbent upon you to make sure that your website's up to date, that you have landing pages for your prospective international students or admitted students, and make sure that there are no challenges for them in terms of getting the information they need in a timely manner, whether they're getting it themselves coming to your site or you're communicating it to them through emails and other means. So there's certainly much to be done in these days, and the to-do list is not going to be shrinking anytime soon. But I certainly wish all of you the best, and know that as your institutions have questions or concerns about how they can develop these kind of programs, please give us a call at SMIE Consulting. Reach out to me, and we'll be certain happy to set up a consult call with you to see how we can help. But for now, that's it from the Midweek Roundup. We look forward to catching up with you next week. And please be sure to subscribe to the podcast if you prefer to get that at your own convenience. So do have a wonderful rest of the week, and stay healthy, stay safe.